out, everybody.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
Today, we're going to be taking a look at the very brutal case of Dan and Ron Lafferty, a pair of brothers who were once devout Mormons who decided that wasn't for them. And so they splinter off and form their own version of a religion called School of Prophets. And these two are just straight evil. All of their newfound religion culminates in two very brutal murders. And so we're going to take a look at their descent into darkness and why on earth they felt like it was a divine calling to brutally murder two innocent individuals. If you're listening to this episode, this is a pre-recording because I am home right now with my baby boy, enjoying some much needed time with my family. So thank you for being here. Appreciate you. And I will be back soon. But let's go ahead and get into how these two brothers descended straight into hell. To fully understand why Ron and Dan Lafferty did what they did, we have to go back to the very beginning of their lives. Ron and Dan Lafferty were raised alongside four brothers and two sisters on a quaint four-acre farm just outside of Salem, Utah. Their father, Watson Lafferty Sr., worked as a barber on an aircraft carrier during World War II before pursuing an education in chiropractic research. After training, their father opened his own business, which included both a chiropractic practice and a barbershop, which he operated from the spare room in their home. Dan described his father as being strong-willed and highly individualistic, rigid in his ways. He was also prone to using violence against his children and even his wife, Claudine, in order to enforce his rules. More often than not, the children were forced to watch him punish the others, and he once used one of the kids' baseball bats to beat the family dog to death. If that wasn't extreme enough, Watson also had his strong doubts about traditional medicine. When Dan's older sister Colleen fell seriously ill with an appendicitis as a child, their dad insisted on treating her at home with prayer and natural remedies. The only time he went to a doctor or hospital was when Colleen's appendix finally burst. She became so ill that she almost died. And ironically, Watson himself later passed away in 1983 because he refused to seek medical care to help manage his diabetes. Despite everything, Dan had a deep love and admiration for his father. As a young man, Dan was always dedicated to his religion. At the time, he was a traditional LDS Mormon. He found joy in attending church near Spring Lake, where he swam, fished, and ice skated with friends. After high school, Dan embarked on a two-year mission to Scotland. And here he met Matilda Loomis, a divorced mother of two young girls who made a very strong impression on him. 6 years later, at a missionary reunion, Dan crossed paths with Matilda once again, and they reconnected. He then prayed to God to ask if he should marry her, just to be sure that the marriage was what God wanted. And he felt like he got a positive response, so that's exactly what he did. He ended up asking Matilda to marry him. And at first, Dan was worried about how Matilda would respond when he told her that he thought God wanted them to be married. But she calmly told him she already knew because she believed God had brought her to America with the sole purpose of being his wife. Within 3 months, Dan and Matilda got married in a temple in Provo, Utah, and then moved to California with Matilda's children. While in California, they attended their local LDS church where Dan listened about plural marriage, even though the Mormon church at this point had officially renounced plural marriage in 1890, quite a ways back. And after he finished chiropractic school, Matilda and Dan would have four more children together. Dan eventually became so deeply involved in researching polygamy among current and former Latter-day Saint members that it began taking up most of his free time. He eventually stumbled across a document titled The Peacemaker in the Brigham Young University Library, which he believed was written by Joseph Smith. Excited by the ideas in The Peacemaker, Dan adopted its principles without question and immediately enforced strict rules on his entire household, severely limiting Matilda's freedom. As an example, Matilda wasn't allowed to drive, handle money, or socialize without Dan present. And all of the children were pulled out of school and not allowed to have any friends. Just like his father, Dan also rejected conventional medical care, relying only on prayer, fasting, and herbal remedies. When their fifth child was born in July of 1983, Dan delivered the baby at home and performed the circumcision himself. That sounds absolutely horrible and absolutely brutal to do to your child at home. Probably not safe. But things reached a new low when the family was short on money and resorted to dumpster diving for leftovers. They eventually began growing their own food. They disconnected from conventional society and stopped using gas and electricity. To isolate his family even further, Dan only allowed books from the LDS Church in his home. Dan also believed they should all learn to tell time using their intuition instead of watches or clocks, which were also banned. I don't know how you use your intuition to tell time. I think the only way to do that is with a clock. So must have been a wild schedule they had. But at home, things were not great. Dan and Matilda's relationship was also not great. She was often beaten for disobeying Dan's rules, and he usually did it in front of their children and in front of others to serve as a warning. At first, she felt hopeful, you know, that their marriage might get better, but things went downhill fast. Soon she felt stuck and often thought about leaving, but decided to stay out of fear of losing her children. And to complicate everything, Dan initially planned to marry his own stepdaughter, Matilda's oldest daughter, but instead decided to marry a young woman named Anne Randick. Anne was a Romanian immigrant who cared for horses, but she wasn't Mormon. Regardless, she agreed to become Dan's second wife. And as time went on, Dan ran into some trouble for illegally running a sandwich business from his home without a license. He also failed to pay taxes. But despite these setbacks, he still managed to finish chiropractic school and later returned to Utah, where his father hired him as his personal chiropractor. Dan's parents sold their farm and bought a house in Provo, where Dan and his brother Mark managed the chiropractic practice while their parents were on a mission for the LDS Church. Dan and Mark were very close and often discussed religion and government conspiracies during their lunch breaks, with Dan often using scriptures from the Book of Mormon to support his arguments against the government. The more he studied historical Mormon texts, the more Dan became convinced that the LDS Church had deviated from its true path in 1890 when it abandoned plural marriage. After receiving what he believed to be a confirmation from God, Dan returned his driver's license to the state of Utah, revoked his marriage license, and even surrendered his social security card. He disregarded speed limits, which he considered unlawful, and he also stopped paying taxes, including sales taxes, when he went shopping. Kind of sounds like a sovereign citizen to me a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, fuck the government. I'm just a traveler. You know, you have no authority over me. And we all know how that goes.
I love those videos online.
I do too. I'm just like, really? We're really going there?
Like, I get being anti-authority, but you're just being a nuisance at that point.
Like, yeah.
Oh my God.
It makes no logical sense.
No,
either.
No.
But feeling empowered by what he saw as the righteousness of his cause, Dan announced his candidacy for sheriff of Utah County in the summer of 1982, and he even launched a political campaign. He participated in public forums, radio interviews, and local parades, and pledged to enforce laws based on a strict interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. However, on October 4th, 1982, while driving home after meeting a rival candidate, Dan was pulled over by a Utah state trooper for speeding and not having proper vehicle registration. And as you just heard, Dan is going to make this very difficult. He doesn't like to be pulled over. He doesn't like to follow the speed limit. And so this was absolutely one of those cop videos where a trooper pulls over a sovereign citizen, because Dan assumed that this whole thing was a setup because he thought the government wanted to prevent him from running for office. That's exactly what was going on. Dan refused to get out of the vehicle and demanded a proper arrest warrant while throwing a fit. So he's one of those guys, I'm not getting out unless you have an arrest warrant for me. One of the troopers tried to force Dan out of the vehicle by slamming the window down, and he took advantage of the situation. Dan quickly just sped off. But as if you've watched any episode of Cops, you know that good luck trying to outrun police. Okay, especially the state troopers. They don't fuck around. They'll get your ass. And so, yeah, state troopers chased after him, and they finally caught up with him and arrested him. He was charged with five offenses, including second-degree felony escape and third-degree felony assault. Dan attempted to represent himself in court, another wise decision. But ultimately, his theatrics failed to sway the judges. Why is that not hard to believe? Which this led to a 45-day psychiatric evaluation. Because they're like, bro, you're crazy. What are you talking about? That's kind of funny, honestly, that the judge was like, yeah, we need to get this guy a psych eval. Something's not right. After that, he had to go serve 30 days in jail. His time behind bars would only fuel his rage, though. After his release, he refused to pay property taxes on his father's assets, who was away again on that church mission. Despite Dan's efforts to keep his father's property without paying the taxes, the county ultimately claimed possession of it. All four of his younger brothers would support him in his ongoing battles with the state. In late 1982 through early 1983, Dan's efforts took on a more radically religious undertone, and his younger brothers happily followed suit. They started meeting regularly to discuss topics such as the ban against polygamy, but when three of Dan's brothers tried to enforce these beliefs on their own wives, the women were not happy about it. They said, hell no. They collectively expressed their concerns to Ron's wife, Diana, hoping she could talk some sense into them. At the time, Ron Lafferty was a city councilman, a respected member of the local LDS congregation, well-liked, and successful in school and sports, and he had also served a two-year mission for the LDS church. Absolutely alarmed by rumors of Ron's brother's eccentric religious practices, Diana urged her husband to talk to them about it. The following week, Ron attended one of his brother's meetings, and it was the first time he had ever gone to one. And throughout the night, he tried to convince them all to listen to the church leaders. He also criticized Dan for his extreme behavior, claiming it didn't align with their faith. Dan passionately argued back about how the church had strayed from its true path by abandoning polygamy. Despite Ron's attempts to counter with scripture, Dan stood his ground, using the same text and even bringing in references from the Constitution to drive his points home. After all the arguing, Ron eventually gave in, admitting Dan had a point. And a sudden shift in Ron's beliefs led him to attend his brother's meetings all the time after that. Like the rest of his brothers, Ron gave up his driver's license and quit his job. Shortly after, Ron had fully embraced Dan's extreme religious approach to life. He was told that Diana had to follow suit. And before going off the deep end, Ron treated Diana with love and respect, but soon after converting to his brother's form of Mormonism, he became extremely controlling and demanding. Diana tried tirelessly to reason with Ron and salvage their relationship, but as Ron's behavior grew more extreme, Diana lost hope of ever restoring their marriage to what it once was. His talk of polygamy and plans to marry off their teenage daughters as plural wives absolutely horrified her. Desperate for help, Diana turned to her friends, hoping to find a solution. After Dan persuaded his brothers to adopt his beliefs, all their wives, including Diana, ultimately submitted to their demands. Everyone except for one person, Brenda Lafferty.
You spend a third of your life in bed. So why are you settling for anything less than the absolute best? Nobody likes an uncomfortable mattress. You know, you wake up with your neck hurting, your back hurting, especially as you get older. I mean, I'm almost 30 and I feel like I'm 50. So I need a nice, soft, comforting mattress. And that's where Helix Sleep comes in. Of course, everyone has different needs for their mattress, and that's where Helix's Sleep Quiz comes in clutch. Helix's Sleep Quiz matches you to the perfect mattress based on your body type and your sleep preferences. It makes the mattress buying process so simple and easy. Not only that, they have a Happy Helix Guarantee. Rest easy with seamless returns and exchanges. They want every customer to have the right mattress for them. Helix delivers your mattress right to your door with free shipping in the U.S. The mattress comes rolled up in a box and is very easy to set up. Helix also offers a 120-night sleep trial to test the mattress out and ensure that you love it. Also, all Helix mattresses come with a lifetime warranty. 82% of participants saw an increase in their deep sleep cycle in Helix's Wesper sleep study. Helix has been reviewed against hundreds of competitors and always wins. Helix was recently a USA Today's Most Trusted Brand winner for 2026. In a study reviewing 23,000 brands, USA Today ranked Helix as one of the most trusted brands in 2026. The Helix Midnight Lux has been ranked as the best overall mattress, according to both Forbes and Wired. And I can attest to that. It is a comfy, comfy mattress. And they don't just make mattresses. They also have pillows. Like the Helix Comfort Adjust Cooling Pillow is a pillow that can be customized to support every sleeping position and preference. The Comfort Adjust Pillow is a great option for those looking to upgrade their comfort without spending too much money. Also, invest in a durable pillow that uses premium memory foam, which keeps its shape and feel over time. Most pillows are one size fits all. Your body is not. Invest in a pillow that you can customize for your body over time. So if you're ready to get rid of that old mattress and cozy into something that's just like sleeping on a cloud, get Helix. Visit helixsleep.com/lightsout to take advantage of their spring savings event and get 20% off site-wide. Thank you, Helix, for sponsoring today's episode.
There was a time long, long ago where I would absolutely avoid going to the doctors purely off the basis that it was such a hassle to get a doctor's appointment. And thanks to ZocDoc, they have made it so easy to book a doctor's appointment or book an appointment with any medical provider that you need, all through the ZocDoc app or website. Because ZocDoc is a free app and website that helps you find and book high-quality in-network doctors so you can find someone you love. You can book in-network appointments with more than 150,000 providers across all 50 states, whether you're looking for dermatology, dentistry, primary care, eye care, or one of the other 200-plus specialties offered by ZocDoc. You can easily search by specialty or symptom to build a care team that's right for you. It's super nice to be able to read real patient reviews so you can actually see what people are saying about their care from the doctor. So ZocDoc is the easiest way to book an appointment. So stop putting off those doctor's appointments and just go to ZocDoc.com/lightsout to find and instantly book a doctor you love today. That's ZocDoc.com/lightsout. ZocDoc.com/lightsout. Thanks, ZocDoc, for sponsoring this message. So let's talk a little bit about who Brenda Lafferty is, because she will become very important here soon. Brenda Lafferty was born on July 19th, 1960, and she was the second oldest of seven kids, and she grew up in Logan, Utah with her parents, LaRae and Jim Wright. When Jim pursued his doctorate at Cornell University, the family moved to Ithaca, New York before settling in Twin Falls, Idaho. She had an unbreakable bond with her sisters, Betty and Bonnie, growing up, and they'd often visit their grandparents' farm together in Helmville, Montana, where Brenda cherished riding their horse named Happy. Her younger sister, Sharon, fondly remembers Brenda as a nurturing presence, despite their nine-year age difference. And Brenda loved movies. She loved scrapbooking and going on secret joyrides with her younger siblings. Her favorite snack was sesame sticks, which she got from Sears, where she used to work before going off to college. After graduating in 1978, Brenda pursued her dream of becoming a broadcast journalist and competed in the Miss Twin Falls, Idaho pageant, where she won first runner-up and earned a college scholarship. Less than a year later, Brenda enrolled at the University of Idaho, but later transferred to Brigham Young University, where she met Alan Lafferty, the youngest brother of the Lafferty family. Brenda got involved in theater programs at both schools she attended, but she really wanted to finish her education at BYU. So she used her scholarship money from the Twin Falls pageant to help cover tuition as she earned her degree in broadcast journalism. And from there, she landed a job as a news anchor at BYU TV's Daily News Show, working with Dale Cressman and Bob Waltz. In 1982, she got married and began attending church on the regular. Despite being married, she continued her job as a news anchor at BYU, and she soon became pregnant. Brenda put her broadcasting career on hold as they adjusted to being new parents. But tensions grew in Brenda's marriage over Alan's religious beliefs and unorthodox business practices. Things got even rockier when their daughter Erica got sick. Alan, who is deeply influenced by his extreme religious beliefs, also refused medical attention like the rest of his family. Brenda clashed with the Laffertys over their ideas about the wives having more autonomy and freedom. She was a rock for Diana as well, supporting her escape from Ron's abuse and even helping her get a divorce. Meanwhile, Ron and his brothers were becoming increasingly drawn to the ideas of another polygamous group led by John W. Bryant. Brenda, however, was adamantly against it, despite Alan's openness to the idea. By late 1983, the Lafferty brothers, except for Alan, found themselves following another charismatic polygamist named Bernard Brady, who went by Prophet Onias. During a late-night meeting, the men felt a powerful connection and a shared belief that they were on a special mission from God that would be part of history. Onias claimed to have received a divine directive: deliver his book to other LDS church leaders. The book was an ultimatum and not a request. They had to fully support Onias or face divine punishment. While it seems laughable to outsiders, the Lafferty brothers were true believers, and they saw Onias as a powerful ally, someone who could help them reform the Mormon church back towards plural marriage. Onias also noticed how zealous the Lafferty brothers were regarding their faith, and by early 1984, the School of Prophets led by Onias held regular meetings at the Lafferty's parents' house in Provo, Utah. The brothers helped get the school off the ground, and on January 8th, Onias dropped a bombshell. He claimed to have received another message from God declaring that the Lafferty brothers were chosen ones destined for greatness before they were born, of course. That's one way to get people excited about your cult, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell them that they were destined for greatness before they were ever born. A few weeks later, another divine message appointed Ron Lafferty as the bishop of the school's Provo chapter. Since Ron commanded respect from his brothers, this decision was fully supported by the entire cult. But things hadn't been easy for Ron. He lost his job, his family had moved away, and he was excommunicated from the LDS Church for good reason. His journal entries revealed a growing sense of closeness to God, and he believed there was a reason for his struggles. But with this newfound closeness to God, there's also this growing darkness happening. Ron's frustrations turned into anger, especially towards those he held responsible for his wife leaving him. They included Richard Stowe, the man who oversaw his excommunication from the LDS Church, Chloe Lowe, a church leader who counseled Diana, and his sister-in-law, Brenda Lafferty. As the School of Prophets became Ron's new obsession, he immersed himself completely, and soon, like Onias, he began claiming to receive messages from God. In a span of 2 months, he allegedly received around 20 divine messages, with one particular instructing Ron to kill Brenda Lafferty, her infant child, Chloe Lowe, and Richard Stowe. So Brenda was no longer safe, not just from Ron and his extremist beliefs, but from her own husband, Alan Lafferty. Though she didn't know about Ron's twisted plan to remove her, she had reasons to fear the Lafferty brothers. Whenever she challenged them, especially Alan, his anger would flare and he would often get physically violent towards her. And one winter night in 1984, Brenda's desperation drove her to call her sister Betty. She thought her only escape was to leave Alan and move to Montana with her baby. But Brenda later had a change of heart because Alan convinced her to stay. Her sister Betty would always regret not pushing Brenda to leave. On another occasion, Brenda's parents offered to have her come live with them in Idaho. But even in moments of despair, she didn't accept the offer. Meanwhile, Ron and Dan were on a cross-country road trip that was fueled by long conversations and Ron's growing instability. Dan turned to prayer for answers, clinging to his brother despite what was coming. On their travels, they met two young men named Ricky Knapp and Chip Carnes. They formed a good bond with them along the way, but sometime during their journey, Ron received a disturbing revelation. They were being called to eliminate certain people who were enemies to their ideologies and that they had to murder them by slitting their throats. Years later, when Brenda's sister finally learned this horrifying truth, she was left reeling. Even more disturbing was the fact that Ron and Dan had openly discussed it in front of other witnesses who didn't intervene. On July 24th, a religious impulse apparently compelled Dan to modify a shotgun stored at his mother's house and turn it into a club. At the same time, Ron, Ricky Knapp, and Chip Carnes loaded their rifles into a car along with their belongings. Meanwhile, Chip expressed that he was hesitant about harming a baby. Ron disagreed, insisting that Erica was beyond salvation and needed to be eliminated. He defended his position by arguing it would be merciful to reunite an orphan with its deceased mother. And with no further argument, they finished loading up the car and the group headed to Mark Lafferty's farm to pick up a shotgun. Once there, Mark directly questioned Ron's motives and recalled his response being pretty cryptic. He said that he was going hunting for anything that got in his way. After loading up on ammo and guns, the group went to a gravel quarry to test fire their newly acquired weapons and get the sights dialed in, but quickly realized that they had grabbed the wrong ammo for one of the rifles. So they all headed back to Mark's place to grab the correct ammo and Ron's .243 Winchester rifle before making their way to Brendan Allen's house. Which leads us to July 24th, 1984. At around 1:30 in the afternoon, Dan drove his Impala into Alan's driveway in front of a brick duplex where he lived with Brenda and his 18-month-old daughter, Erica. Ron stepped out of the car and approached the door alone, carrying the sawed-off shotgun barrel Dan had made earlier, intending to use it as a club. He hit it up his right sleeve, and he also had a 10-inch boning knife tucked into his left boot. He opened the screen door and knocked several times loudly. No one answered. According to Karn's nap, after a few minutes, Ron turned around, returned to the car, and shrugged in defeat. As they started to drive away, Dan suddenly wanted to turn around and try again. Making a hard U-turn, the other men in the car all asked him what he was doing, and he eerily responded, "I'm going back to Allen's, but I don't understand why." With that being said, Dan pulled back into Allen's driveway, walked up to the door, and knocked. This time, after only two or three knocks, Brenda opened it. Dan asked if Allen was home, and she said he was at work. Then Dan asked if the .243 deer rifle was in their apartment, but Brenda said no. Finally, he requested to use her phone, and she firmly declined. He insisted, "I only just need to make a quick call," but Brenda was already suspicious of him, refused to let him inside. Dan then pushed past her and forced his way into the house. According to Karnes, who was waiting in the car, the front door slammed shut after Dan forced his way in. Following that, he heard sounds like someone hitting the floor and a vase breaking. Dan would later claim that as he pushed his way inside, he remembered how much it unnerved Brenda. She immediately started apologizing for her role in turning Ron's wife and Allen against them, but it was too late. He later admitted thinking to himself that Brenda was a bitch and that he felt inspired to wrestle her to the ground, where he ultimately pinned her on her stomach and held her wrists firmly behind her. Outside the apartment, Karnes, Knapp, and Ron were still waiting in the Impala when Karnes turned to Knapp, saying, "It's getting noisy in there." Knapp agreed and suggested that Ron go in and help his brother. So that's exactly what he did. However, when he tried to enter the house, Dan had Brenda pinned on the floor against the door, so Ron had to push his way inside. But as soon as Ron got inside, the two men in the car heard Brenda scream, "I knew it was going to come to this," before they heard Ron call her a bitch and a liar, and then more glass breaking. After a few minutes, they heard Brenda scream again, but this time she begged them not to hurt her baby, as Ron was still calling her a bitch and a liar while continuing to beat her. Then they heard a little girl cry out, "Mommy, mommy, mommy." And then after that, everything got quiet. It would later be revealed by Dan that Ron had tried to knock Brenda unconscious with his fist as he punched her in the face over and over again. At that point, enough blood had spilled for Dan to lose his grip on Brenda, allowing her to stand up. Ron quickly positioned himself to block her from escaping. She pleaded with Dan to hold her, but he suspected she was just seeking sympathy, which only angered him further. Brenda then became quiet, and feeling desperate, she offered to do whatever they wanted. Ron coldly instructed her to sit in a corner, and she obeyed. Seeing an opportunity to leave, Ron whispered to Dan that they should get out of there, but Dan insisted he felt a sense of divine guidance. He assured Ron that he would handle what he believed he was meant to do. As Brenda attempted to flee again, Dan stopped her just as she reached the kitchen. Struggling with Brenda, Dan said that he did what he believed God wanted him to do, and Brenda soon fainted, and Dan asked Ron to find something to restrain her. Ron fetched a vacuum cord, but as he tried to use it, he was pushed away by what seemed like an unseen force. Recognizing this as a sign, Dan took the cord and tightly secured it around Brenda's neck as he waited for her to regain consciousness. He then made his way to Brenda's daughter's room, Erica. Once inside the room, he proceeded to slit her throat so badly that he almost decapitated her. When Brenda came to, Dan told her about how he brutally murdered her baby. Then he proceeded to strangle her with the vacuum cord, and then proceeded to slit her throat. According to the men in the car, Ron was visibly shaken when they returned, but Dan was composed and fully convinced that they had acted on God's behalf. The brothers' bloody clothes also caught the attention of Knapp and Karnes, and they noticed how casually Dan changed his shirt before they continued their mission. While driving to their next target, Ron and Dan discussed their plans to fulfill God's command. By now, Ron was doubting their ability to carry out the remaining tasks, but Dan tried to reassure him that it was their duty to follow the Lord's will. On the drive, Knapp finally asked Dan and Ron about what had exactly happened back at Brenda and Allen's. Dan horrifically told them the bloody details, confirming that he had committed the murders, but Karnes would remember it differently and blame the killings on Ron, even though he wasn't inside the house. According to Karn's testimony later on, Ron frequently talked about how he would unleash a brutal attack on Brenda before ultimately killing her. He remembered how Ron bragged about how he wanted to inflict pain on her before taking her life. Later on, Brenda Lafferty and her 15-month-old daughter, Erica, were found murdered in their home. The investigation quickly focused on members of a religious group known as the School of Prophets, particularly Kenyon Blackmore and Bernard Brady, but this investigation into them led nowhere. At the time, the killers were fleeing Utah and the Lafferty brothers became fugitives overnight. They stopped at a motel in Wendover, Nevada, where they bought food and drinks from a nearby store. But suddenly, Ron decided to leave, and they were later stopped during a routine traffic stop in Nevada. A highway patrol officer pulled them over, but they avoided getting caught. Back at the motel, tensions were high as Carnes and Knapp realized they were in serious trouble. So Carnes convinced Knapp that they make a run for it while Ron and Dan were still asleep. Paranoia and guilt ate away at them as they drove north toward Cheyenne, Wyoming, and they destroyed any evidence that could link them to the crime. When they finally made it to Carnes' place, they hoped that they were in the clear, but police were at the door within a few hours. Carnes and Knapp fully cooperated with law enforcement, and the information they shared ultimately led to the recovery of important evidence and the arrest of the Lafferty brothers. Bernard Brady, an investor in the Dream Mine and the collaborator with Kenyon Blackmore, returned home on July 25th. It was an ordinary day until he approached his home and noticed police cars lining the street and officers swarming his house. Inside, his family sat on the couch, surrounded by police. Even though Brady protested, claiming their warrant had the wrong address, the officers continued their search. Meanwhile, the Lafferty brothers woke up in their motel room to find Carnes and Knapp gone, along with their belongings, including the car. Ron was pissed, but Dan took it surprisingly well. He thought it was a stroke of luck. The brothers then headed to Reno before splitting up to avoid detection. Ron hunkered down at a local casino while Dan spent the night in a historic train car before meeting up later. And for the next few weeks, Ron and Dan spent time in Sparks and Reno. They used a free shuttle bus for transportation and attempted to blend into the lively gambling atmosphere. They even became friends with the bus driver who allowed them to sleep on the bus overnight. Dan considered this gesture a blessing from God and proof that they had done the right thing. Every evening after the driver completed his route, he hid them under the seats as he parked the bus downtown in a secure lot. During the day, they escaped the heat by hiding in the cool air-conditioned halls of the Peppermill Casino. Dan fondly remembers watching the Olympics on the big screens and snagging free chips and nachos with daily coupons in the lobby. Nachos would become their main source of food. After a few days, they encountered another man who got them marijuana and even lent Dan his ID since he didn't have one. The man looked almost exactly like a younger version of Ron. And since the man's appearance was so familiar, Dan felt like the guy was some sort of guardian angel looking out for them, and further proof that they were justified in carrying out these murders. On a previous trip to Reno, they also became fast friends with a woman named Debbie, a blackjack dealer at Circus Circus. She offered them a place to stay after Dan claimed he had miraculously healed Debbie's sick puppy with a simple blessing.
Look, taking care of your mental health shouldn't be harder than taking care of your physical health. If you pull a muscle, you go see a doctor. But when it comes to finding the right therapist, suddenly it's frustrating. You've got long wait lists, or you're staring down huge out-of-pocket costs. That's where Rula comes in. Rula makes therapy simple, affordable, and fast. They work with most major insurance plans, and the average session copay is just $15. $15. That's basically the cost of lunch. And with Rula, you're not just matched and left to figure it out. They check in and make sure you're actually making progress. Every therapist on the platform is licensed, vetted, and picked for their expertise. So you know you're talking to someone legit, not just whoever happens to be available. Getting started couldn't be easier. You answer a few quick questions about what matters to you, and Rula connects you with in-network providers who actually fit your needs. You pick the time, and you could be talking to a therapist as soon as the next day. Bottom line, if you've been putting this off, Rula takes away the excuses. Simple, affordable, and actually built to help you get better. Rula isn't just a directory. They help you book appointments, stay on top of your schedule, and keep track of progress so you actually get somewhere with therapy. Thousands of guys have already used Rula to finally get the care they needed. Don't keep putting it off. Go to rula.com/lightsout and get started today. That's rula.com/lightsout. Take the first step, get connected, and take control of your mental health.
This podcast is sponsored by Smalls. Smalls has been a lifesaver in my home because my cats, a lot of them are starting to get up there in age, and my cats are in the geriatric range. And one of the things that I did was switch them to Smalls because for the last couple of years, when they were eating the dry food, it seemed to be coming right back up. And there'd just be little piles of dry food everywhere. Smalls Fresh cat food is protein-packed, and all the recipes are made with preservative-free, 100% human-grade ingredients that you'd find in your fridge, and best of all, it's delivered to your door. That's why Cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. And for a limited time, you get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/lightsout. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements, which is a huge deal. And the team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free, which means they will refund you if your cat won't eat their food. So stop guessing which meals will upset their stomach. For a limited time, because you're a Lights Out listener, you can get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/lightsout. Yeah, you heard that right. One last time. That's 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/lightsout. Eventually, after a few weeks of evading police, the brothers were finally arrested on August 7, 1984. Police arrested them while they waited in line at the Circus Buffet. By December, things had taken a strange turn after Ron tried to murder Dan while they were both locked up in jail. Ron's attack, fueled by his wild beliefs and supposed messages from God, left Dan seriously injured but alive. After the assault, Ron's mental state got even worse. He started thinking about finishing what he'd started and taking Dan out for good. He even claimed that he had received a new message from God. Ron claimed God wanted Dan to let his brother kill him, but Dan didn't believe him, which only made Ron more desperate. He then tried to commit suicide by hanging in a cell, but failed and was taken to the hospital. This got people in the polygamous community talking, wondering how he managed to survive despite his mental health rapidly going downhill. This suicide attempt also raised the question of whether he was fit to stand trial. Both Dan and Ron faced charges of 2 counts of first-degree murder. However, shortly before their joint trial was scheduled to commence on December 29, 1985, Ron attempted suicide again by hanging himself in his cell. Emergency responders were able to revive him, but he remained in a coma for 2 days. Why'd they revive him, let's be honest. But after this, the judge ordered further psychiatric evaluation for Ron. This led to a decision to proceed with only Dan's trial for the time being. Dan opted to represent himself at the trial, and the trial lasted 5 days, and the jury deliberated for 9 hours before finding him guilty on both charges. Only 10 of the 12 jurors agreed on giving Dan the death penalty, so he ended up getting 2 life sentences in prison instead. Later, during Ron's trial, the prosecution described how he killed Brenda before passing the knife to his brother Dan, then thanked him for murdering Erica. However, Dan disputed this, insisting he was responsible for Brenda's death, which makes it unclear which brother murdered whom exactly. In 1991, Colorado's 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver overturned Ron's 1985 conviction. The court stated that the lower court had erred in assessing Ron's mental health for the trial. They pointed out his paranoid beliefs since, you know, he thought he only had to follow God's laws and not the human ones. It was argued that he suffered severe mental illness and should have been deemed unfit to stand trial at the time. As a result, Ron's mental state was reevaluated and he prepared for a new trial. In 1994, after undergoing 16 months of psychotherapy and being put on several different antidepressant medications and antipsychotic medications, Ron Lafferty was deemed fit to stand trial again for the murders of Brenda and Eric Lafferty. This decision followed a hearing at which a team of doctors appointed by the prosecution successfully convinced the court of Ron's competency. Despite Ron claiming he was sane, his defense team leaned towards arguing insanity, saying his strong religious beliefs were a sign of mental illness. During the hearings before the trial, Ron's strange behavior in court worsened. He wore a sign to ward off evil spirits, which also supported the argument of his mental instability. But expert witnesses from both sides gave conflicting opinions about Ron's mental health. During Ron Lafferty's retrial in 1996, the psychologist, Dr. Robert Howell, said Ron had a delusional disorder that made him mentally unfit to stand trial. Dr. Howell cited Ron's belief that the family should handle all legal matters and talking to spirits as proof of his insanity. But the prosecution brought in experts who said Ron wasn't insane. Dr. Noel Gardner, also a psychiatrist, said Ron's beliefs were unusual, but they didn't mean he was legally insane. Dr. Gardner explained that some religious beliefs might seem weird to outsiders, but can be considered normal in religious communities. Dr. Gardner's testimony emphasized the cultural context of religious beliefs and their impact on an individual's perception. He rejected the idea that Ron's extreme beliefs were proof of insanity, but pointed out his upbringing, and cultural influences. Psychologist Dr. Richard Wooton, who was a practicing Mormon, shared Gardner's views. He said that Ron's beliefs, although unusual, were still part of a deeper conversation about religion. And by the end of the retrial, the jury found him guilty once again and decided he should be executed. Given a choice, Ron Lafferty decided he wanted to be killed by a firing squad. And all of his later attempts to appeal his case to the Supreme Court of Utah and the U.S. Supreme Court would be turned down. However, more than 17 years after Ron was first sentenced for the murders of Brenda and Erica Lafferty, he received news in 2002 that a warrant had been issued for his execution. The judge informed him of the state's decision and gave him 30 days to decide whether to challenge his conviction. Ron stated that he had the intention to pursue all available appeals and was determined to fight against his execution. Unfortunately, Ron would never face the firing squad. At the age of 78, he passed away in 2019 from natural causes while in prison. The reactions from the victims' families were mixed. Sharon Weeks, Brenda Lafferty's sister, voiced her frustration. She stated that Ron's death behind bars didn't bring them the closure they sought. They felt cheated. She urged Utah to reconsider the death penalty, advocating for a life sentence without parole instead. On the other hand, Brenda's father Jim felt differently about Ron's death in prison. He expressed relief, mentioning that his family had relied on their faith and the legal system to navigate the situation. As for Dan Lafferty, he remains at the Utah State Prison, where he will die serving a double life sentence. To this very day, he has never expressed remorse or apologized for the murders. In July 2003, John Krakauer wrote the book Under the Banner of Heaven, which was the first book to shed light on the Lafferty murders and reignite public interest in this tragic case. 8 years later, in 2011, Warner Brothers acquired the rights to adapt the book into a movie, which was directed by Ron Howard. In April 2022, it was developed into a limited TV series for FX, which premiered on Hulu. Today, Sharon Weeks, Brenda Lafferty's sister, is a passionate advocate for justice who strongly opposes the death penalty, believing that it is unjust. Instead, she is pushing for Utah to adopt life imprisonment without parole. While some argue for changes to the death penalty, Sharon emphasizes the need for closure for victims. She's disappointed because she feels her family didn't get justice in Ron Lafferty's case because the legal process cost a lot of taxpayer money and didn't support the victims as it should have. She also finds it troubling that Ron Lafferty became famous during the trial. She believes he should have spent the rest of his life in prison without anyone talking about him. Sharon is motivated by her desire to prevent others from experiencing the same suffering her family endured and is certain her sister Brenda would have supported the cause. She has spoken to lawmakers, including former Utah State Representative V. Lowry Snow and Senator Daniel McKay, to try to change the law. She has also recently spoken out against a television series claiming that her sister's identity has been lost in it. Sharon doesn't resent the show's writer and emphasizes with his viewpoint, but she emphasized that the show should be regarded as fiction and that it failed to accurately depict Brenda as she was. She also believed it unfairly associated Brenda's murder with the history of their church, despite Brenda's love for her faith, and that it overlooked the true motives behind the murders by placing an excessive focus on religion. Her main concern with the show is that it misrepresents Brenda's character, which she finds distressing and disrespectful to the memory of her sister and her niece, which I agree with that. I don't know why we're making movies based off horrific crimes like this. Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
I don't get it. And without their permission, too.
Yeah.
To just go and make this without consulting with the victims' families is a whole other thing. But my God, what pieces of shit. Dan and Ron. And not everybody associated with the school prophets. What a fucking joke.
Very
sad excuse for a bunch of fucking delusional men to do whatever they want, basically. That's, yeah. You know. To justify their evil actions, destroy a family, kill a child. It's just inexcusable and disgusting, honestly. There's really not much I'll say about it. It's just horrible.
There's not much you can really argue here. I mean, murdering an infant child like that, basically just because you want to have an open marriage is absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
The religious delusion these men went through is absolutely disgusting, and they don't deserve to walk free. And they don't deserve to walk, in my opinion.
No, I agree. It's such a shame, too. Like, if you're going to hand down the death penalty, at least follow through with it. The fact that he escaped that is just insane. It is like, what's the point of that? So I empathize with Brenda's family. Like, this is just horrible. And I'm sure it's difficult to feel like there's any closure in this case at all. And also just, you know, with movies and adaptions to TV, I mean, you are, you know, giving them sort of a spotlight, you know, kind of making them infamous at that point. But overall, a horribly disgusting, disturbing case. And it's just another example of people using religion as an excuse to be evil.
Yeah.
It's really what it is at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But I definitely want to know your thoughts on the Lafferty brothers. You think they got the punishment they deserved? Should they have both been handed down a life sentence without parole? Or do you think the death penalty is a more suitable punishment here? Let us know your thoughts. Thank you for being here. I'll see you guys next time. Lights out, everybody.